Continue with scattering theory. This is a pretty interesting topic, I think. And what we're going to be getting into later today is two of the tools. Well, actually today we'll only cover the first of the main tools of scattering theory. One is perturbative scattering theory, which basically is usually called the Born approximation, first order perturbation theory of scattering. And then next time, I guess, we'll be getting into the real exact theory of scattering, which has a lot of interesting parallels of quantum mechanics when we introduce scattering phase shifts and make use of all of our vector spherical harmonic technology. So you have that to look forward to, because it's hard to have more fun than that. So we had intro, did I start the recorder? Yeah. So yeah, last time we imagined detecting the polar with polarization sensitivity, a source that hits a small dielectric sphere, much smaller than the wavelength, and the incident light's unpolarized, but we detect polarization of the radiation, defined this way as the difference between perpendicular and parallel to the scattering plane polarizations divided by the sum. So it's kind of interesting. You get polarization in the scattered light, even though it was unpolarized coming in. Also, we derived the differential cross-section for scattering of unpolarized radiation, the total scattering without polarization sensitivity in the detection. And from this, we could work out this differential cross-section and can calculate the integrated total scattering cross-section in the usual way, integrating over sine theta, d phi. This is a simple integral. Maybe I won't bother you with the details of working out that simple integral. And that works out to be sigma naught times 8 pi over 3, or plug in what we had written for sigma naught last time. It's 8/3. Is there no pi in there? Yeah, I think I left it out. The formula for some reason, 8 pi over 3 epsilon r minus 1 over epsilon r plus 2 squared ka to the fourth power times pi a squared, which is the cross-sectional area of the sphere that the scatterer sees coming into a sphere. If we wanted to sketch this to get a pictorial representation, we would see something like a graph. We could plot the differential cross section first, d sigma d omega, and divide it by sigma naught as a function of theta, 0 to pi. Then this is a curve that actually peaks at 0 and pi in the forward and backward directions, has a smallish minimum, I forget, down around a half at pi over 2, sideways scattering, and on the other hand, the polarization peaks at pi over 2 and vanishes in the forward and backward directions. So that's pi of theta, and d sigma d omega is here. Okay, so that's one case of working out in this long wavelength limit the scattering of a dielectric sphere. But we're not satisfied with that. There are other things that might scatter, like little metallic particles in the atmosphere. So there are some interesting differences if instead of a dielectric, you've got a conducting sphere that's going to do the scattering. So I want to work that out next. And we'll assume it's a perfect conductor for this simple derivation. So let's start with remembering something from E&M1. If we go all the way back in our memory to section 2.5, we treated there in that section a perfect conducting sphere. That you place in an electric field. And we found it acquires an electric dipole moment. And I'll remind you of that formula. As it rearranges the charges on the conducting sphere. I think this was derived using the method of images. 4 pi epsilon naught A cubed times the applied external field. And this result could also be derived a different way. By letting epsilon for a dielectric sphere go to infinity, just as a side point. So it's a pretty basic result that this is what an electric field does to a dielectric sphere. Now there's an analogous result we found in chapter 5 for magnetic field. Which I want to review before we tackle the actual radiation case. Where's your homework?
Talk to you about that later.
Okay. So next point is that if you take a uniform static magnetic field, and apply it to a conducting sphere, this will induce a magnetic moment. And in fact, it induces a uniform magnetization in the sphere, which was derived, this was 5.115, if you want to review that, was 3 over mu naught times mu minus mu naught over mu plus 2 mu naught times the incident or externally applied magnetic field, or magnetic induction, I should call it. And the limit of going to a conducting sphere is achieved by letting mu go to 0, basically, which then is minus 3/2 times the incident magnetic field H is the magnetization in the sphere. And so the dipole moment, because it's constant, will be the volume of the sphere, little m, will be 4/3 pi a cubed times that constant magnetization, which you recall is the magnetic dipole moment per unit volume induced. So that's minus 2 pi a cubed h incident. And there's another way to understand this result, which is based on equation 5.112 in Jackson, that if you have a uniformly magnetized sphere, the relation between the field inside and the external field is, B inside is the external or incident field plus 2 mu naught over 3 times the magnetization. And what we expect for a perfect conductor is B inside should be 0. So that implies that the magnetization will have to be minus 3 over 2 mu naught B incident. And again, that leads to this magnetic dipole moment, little m, 4/3 pi a cubed capital M, or minus 2 pi a cubed H incident. So now, let's do radiation fields using this logic that we learned for the static case. And the monochromatic situation follows a lot of these same ideas. So now, for radiation case, we'll have H incident related to the electric field incident as the incident's direction n naught unit vector crossed into E electric field incident over Z naught. And then what we're going to do is we're going to calculate the total fields of the scattered radiation by adding the fields due to the electric and magnetic dipole radiators. So for instance, the electric field of the scattered radiation will have these both parts, E field due to the electric dipole induced, and the E field due to the magnetic dipole induced. In the long wavelength limit, these should be the dominant multiples that contribute. Okay, so we already know basically the fields for electric and magnetic dipoles. So the E1 electric field, looking back, I think this was equation 10.2, one of the first equations in the chapter, k squared over 4 pi epsilon naught, so we're still in SI units, e to the ikr over r in the radiation zone, n hat cross p cross n hat, which we could also write as minus k squared a cubed, a being the radius of the sphere, times the magnitude, strength of the incident E field, the outward propagating e to the ikr over r, and then we could write this as n hat cross e0 unit vector, which is the direction of the electric field incident. And then similarly, the formula for the M1 radiation, its electric field, was worked out. And actually, you can get this from E and H of the electric dipoles, as I wrote in the notes, but let me just write the formula, minus Z naught K squared over 4 pi e to the ikr over r, n hat cross the magnetic dipole moment, which is minus mu naught epsilon naught to the 1/2 over 4 pi epsilon naught k squared e to the ikr over r n hat cross m. And another way to write that is k squared a cubed over 2 times e naught. What's e naught? I think that's e incident. E to the ikr over r and n hat cross n naught hat cross e naught. Anyway, lots of details with these fields, but you might be more interested if I remind you that you can get them if you are stranded on a desert island and you happen to remember the electric field due to an electric dipole radiator, but not the magnetic one. You could get EM1 and HM1 from the electric dipole radiators, EE1 and HE1, by replacing E in the E1 case by Z naught H, and replacing H from the electric dipole radiator by minus E over Z naught, and replace P by magnetic dipole moment over the speed of light. Okay, they're almost exact parallel between these two cases. All right, so with that, we can just take the fields add them together and get the differential cross section for scattering, which depends on all these vectors. It depends on E hat, N hat of our detector, where we place our detector relative to the origin in the scatterer. It depends on the incident polarization and direction of propagation. And this will equal k to the fourth. It will again have units of area. So it's k fourth, a to the sixth. And then a bunch of angle stuff. Combine the two fields. We have E hat star dotted into N hat cross E naught minus a half N hat cross N naught hat cross E naught. Curly brackets squared. Okay. So that can be simplified. I'm not going to drag you through that algebra, though. You might want to verify on your own. You can derive the next equation. Using the back cab rule and all that stuff and simplifying, you can get this in the form. It depends on all those vectors, k to the fourth, a to the sixth, e hat star dot e naught, which is, I think, what you would normally expect for the electric dipole to simplify to just a dot product of the incident and detected electric fields, but then minus a half n cross e hat star dotted into n naught cross e naught and absolute square of all that. All right, so remind you that we're talking about radiation coming in, hitting our sphere, coming out to a detector, and we had a right-handed coordinate system with S naught and S in the scattering plane, and N naught propagation and N detection unit vectors. And then T was the cross product of N naught with S naught would be out of the scattering plane in the right-handed rule sense, T and T naught. So we can do the same thing I think we wrote before for the dipole radiator, or dipole scatterer, electric dipole scatterer, I mean. Due to a dielectric sphere we derived last time, can write the four differential cross sections for the four combinations of polarization, incident, and detected. Only two are non-trivial. D sigma d omega for incident and detected in the scattering plane. It's one of the non-trivial ones, and it works out to be k to the fourth, a to the sixth, cos theta minus a half squared. The two trivial cases are where you came in the scattering plane, electric field in the scattering plane, but you detect out of orthogonal to the scattering plane. That is, gives zero, as you might expect. just like I think came true for an electric dipole dielectric sphere. That's zero. Similarly, if you come in incident orthogonal to the scattering plane polarized, but detect in the scattering plane, that gives zero. Not surprising. And but the other non-trivial case is if they're both detected in incident electric fields at right angles to the scattering plane, then you get this formula of E hat is orthogonal and incident is orthogonal. Then you get K to the fourth, A to the sixth, 1 minus 1/2 cos theta squared. So you might see if you can make sure you understand how to get to there from this or from this. So in the notes, I gave some other cases like if you do the differential scattering with no polarization selection, and I worked out the total scattering cross section. Let me write just the total scattering cross section. The others in the notes, don't think we have to dwell on this too much. You'll look up these formulas if you ever need them, probably. But now you know where they came from, I hope. The total after you integrate d sigma d omega for no polarization selection and with an unpolarized incident beam, you get 10 pi over 3, k to the fourth, a to the sixth. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to say about the conducting sphere. Now, we're going to do scattering theory. And one of the reasons I like this subject, which is going to be the next couple of lectures, at least, is that there are quite exact parallels with quantum scattering. One of the first methods you learn in quantum scattering is the Born approximation, and which is good in a couple of different limits. And when the scattering basically is weak, okay, come in and there's just a small fraction of a low, relatively low probability of scattering, then perturbation theory is applicable. And it's pretty simple to derive it using our toolkit. So this is section 10.2 of our favorite tome, treating perturbative scattering. So again, what we treated so far, we only considered the long wavelength limit. And that led us to focus on just the lowest important multiples, E1 and M1, electric and magnetic dipole radiation, coming out of the scatterer from the field caused by the induced fields. So now we're going to develop a method that we can apply even at short wavelengths. when like the wavelength is much less than the size of the scatterer, provided the scattering is weak. So that we can treat it by perturbation theory. So in terms of like a dielectric scatterer, we are talking about the magnitude of epsilon minus epsilon naught over epsilon naught, much less than one. That's what we mean by weak scattering. Okay, so how to do that? When in doubt, what should you do? How to tackle that? Well, we have some equations that control the behavior of our fields. Let's use those. Thank you, James Clerk Maxwell, wherever you are. Let's start from his famous equation in a source-free region. Let's start at the very beginning. It's one thing I like about this course. You can do everything. You start with Maxwell's equations and you march. Yeah. Sorry? Oh, like the size of the scatter. It's just something of the order of the size. If it's a sphere, the radius of the sphere. Okay. I'm going to discuss this for a source-free region because we're thinking of radiation came in from some source far away, strikes our scatterer of whose size is D-ish, and it doesn't have like extra currents with a battery inside the scatterer. So we're going to neglect the sources and only consider things like the fields induced in the scatterer that cause radiation to come out of the scatterer, aside from which will be in addition to the incident radiation going past the scatterer. Okay, well, here are Maxwell's equations. One of my favorites, del dot B is zero. I like that one. This one's okay too, del dot D is zero. When there are no sources, and we've got the curl of E, it's minus dB dt, but we've been working with H, the magnetic field, more than the magnetic induction. So we will write that for monochromatic fields as I Z naught K H. And then the curl of H we'll write as partial D with respect to time, which for monochromatic fields is minus IKCD. All right. And now I'm going to do something that will shock you. I'm going to take the curl of a new vector we've never talked about. Okay, actually I'm going to do a couple of things. I'm going to start by taking the curl of this weird vector, curl of the curl of the vector D minus epsilon naught times E. Okay, so the idea here is, right, if you have the radiation, incident radiations coming in, it's going to maybe see some scatter of size D-ish. In free space, D will equal epsilon naught E, and that quantity I'm taking the curl of twice is, of course, zero. but within the scattering object, D minus epsilon naught E is not zero, but it probably will be smallish if epsilon is close to epsilon naught. Then we're going to have, again, epsilon naught mu naught here, and in the detection region, we'll have epsilon naught mu naught, but inside we'll have, if it's a linear material, we'll have an epsilon and a mu in the material that's doing the scattering. First thing I'm going to do, I'm going to use this in a minute in Maxwell's equations. In a inhomogeneous Helmholtz equation, this will appear, as we'll see in a minute. But let me first recast this as del of del dot D, which we said was zero in a source-free region, minus del squared D. And I can also write that as, with an extra term, epsilon naught curl of dB dt. A second thing I'm going to consider is mu naught epsilon naught d by dt of partial d with respect to time. Sorry for this. I always hated Jackson's derivations like this. Okay, we're just going to consider this quantity. Why? Because it works. We're free, of course, to consider it, but it's a bit hard to have pulled out of the air why these are the two quantities we want to talk about right now. But we are trying to follow JD, his logic, as much as I can. This minus mu naught epsilon naught curl of H, this combination of fields gives zero. Okay, so these are combined to give the following equation. I claim del squared of the vector D minus mu naught epsilon naught second time derivative of D with respect to time is equal to minus the curl of this complicated quantity, curl of D minus epsilon naught E. Remember, that's going to vanish outside the scatterer. Minus epsilon naught d by dt of b minus mu naught h. Which also will vanish outside the scatterer. Similarly. So these are from Jackson, page 463, if you want to make sure you're following his arguments, and in case I omit some important points. This equation, star I will call it, he says is exact in the limit if there are no sources. But he points out that if there are sources, you can add to the right-hand side minus gradient of rho minus mu naught epsilon naught partial j with respect to time. If you want to generalize this logic we're going through, and if these are weak and could also be treated in the Born approximation and the perturbation theory, you could include those if you need to, but we're not going to consider them now. You can drive those on your own in your vast spare time. Okay, so we want to solve for the scattering in this weak scattering limit. And as you might expect, it'll come down to doing an integral. Okay, so we will assume we have some localized source, or scatterer, I should say. Some localized region of space. I'm not assuming it's spherical or anything special about its geometry now. Where epsilon and mu have small differences from the vacuum values. And we'll write this notation as follows to remind us that ourselves that these are assumed to be weak. We'll call that epsilon naught plus delta epsilon of x. It'll be, in the end, a primed acting like a source term in our right-hand side over there. So I'll give it a primed coordinate. And similarly, mu we'll write as mu naught plus some delta mu that's a function of the spatial coordinate. And now we're going to specialize to a harmonic situation, harmonic time dependence. Guess if it's not harmonic, you could tackle this inhomogeneous PDE using the time-dependent Green's function. But it'll be a little simpler if we do the harmonic case, which is usually what we care about for nearly monochromatic radiation. Okay, so if it's harmonic, this becomes the Helmholtz equation. And we have can write symbolically the partial differential equation for the vector d as minus an inhomogeneous vector term. I will call it a source term, although it's not really a source in the sense of rho and j. But in particular, we have a formula over there, which we can read off for minus W source will be that right-hand side over there. Minus curl of the curl of D minus epsilon naught E minus I epsilon naught omega curl of B minus mu naught H. Bit of a complicated inhomogeneity, but that's our life with vector fields. All right, well, we know how to solve Helmholtz equations. If this right-hand side, this source, what I'm calling the source term, if everything in this equation is known, a known quantity, then we can just write the waves it generates, the monochromatic waves this term generates, as an integral over that times the Green's function for the Helmholtz equation. So, right, we've got an inhomogeneous Helmholtz equation. We know the Green's function for the three-dimensional Helmholtz equation. And so that's a straightforward part of our toolkit. D at an arbitrary position will be the D naught you would have without that term for the solution. Basically, this will represent the incident waves, their electric displacement. And then we have the integral d cubed x prime over the Green's function for the chosen omega, chosen frequency, times the source, which is a vector field. So I'll write the arrow. Integrate over x prime. And remember, these terms will all be zero outside the object that has the delta epsilon and delta mu. So this will end up being an integral just over this object. Of course, G, we've now chosen it to obey this version of the Green's function equation without the 4 pi, del squared plus k squared g of xx prime is just a minus delta of x minus x prime without the 4 pi now. And I wrote in the notes, I see that g is e to the ikr over r, but I think that's wrong. I forgot that there's no 4 pi, so it should be corrected in your notes by adding that 4 pi in the denominator. The vector r here, of course, is especially going to be interested in like a vector x, and there will be like a little volume element in the object, which has a vector x prime, and this is a not a legible diagram, and I apologize for that. And there's R. At this point, when I say this is our Green's function, of course I've said there are no boundaries. And we could change the Green's function if we have to accommodate some conducting boundaries in the world, but let's hope we never have to do that as long as we live. Okay. So, strictly speaking, you could say this is an exact equation if you remember that the D and the B on the right-hand side are not known. And then you realize, well, it's not actually a formula for D, it's an integral equation for D. Okay. But in the spirit of perturbation theory, right, you can view this as a successive approximations where you would plug in the incident B, because these delta epsilon and delta mu are weak, that the right-hand side is small, and so the D in the source should be to a good approximation, first approximation, just plug in the incident D. And B minus mu naught H. So this, in that approximation, plug in to the right-hand side, the incident D-naught and B-naught, then we'll get the new field, corrected fields. We'll have the old incident field, D0 of x. And if I look in the far zone, I'll have e to the ikr over r. We'll factor outside of the integral over the object, integral d cubed x prime, e to the minus ikn hat dot x prime over 4 pi, and w source. I didn't write the arrow in the notes, but you should do so. At x prime. And this starts to look like formulas we see in quantum mechanics all the time, where you have an incident plane wave, maybe, for a particle coming into a quantum potential, and it's going to radiate out scattering waves that look like e to the ik over r, spherical scattering waves going to the detectors at infinity times a scattering amplitude. So by analogy, we can write this as d0 of x plus a scattering amplitude, which is now a vector, unlike the quantum case of spinless particles. The scattering amplitude that will depend on the final k vector, which is kn hat, right? And then times the outgoing spherical wave, e to the ikr over r. And so we can write out an explicit formula at this level of approximation for the scattering amplitude. And at this level of approximation, we only have to do an integral to just get the scattered waves at the detector in the far zone. And there will be the 1 over 4 pi, integral over the source, this from the Green's function, e to the ikn hat dot x vector prime times this is the primed curl of the primed curl of d minus epsilon naught e. In the incident wave, again, we'll plug in the incident waves, and then plus I epsilon naught omega prime curl of B minus mu naught H. If it's a magnetic material, this part will be important. And I think I called that double asterisk equation. So there's some simplifications to this expression, which I guess I should go through to give it the final, simplest possible form that's in Jackson. It'll be easier to do the integral. To do that, we'll need some vector calculus identities. Kind we've come to know and love. Recall a scalar times a curl, a volume integral of that can be written as the curl of the prime curl of the scalar times the vector function. Minus the gradient, prime gradient of the scalar crossed into the vector function. And one reason of doing that is because the volume integral of the curl of psi A, you'll remember, or you can refer to the inside covers of Jackson for these kind of formulas, can be written as the closed surface integral over some surface containing all of the source as n hat prime crossed into psi A. DA prime. It's another typo I see in my notes. I hadn't noticed till now. In the notes, I wrote that as D cubed X prime, which is, of course, wrong. You might change D cubed X prime in your notes to DA prime. So if we have localized source, we go to a surface outside of the source, we can have that identity, and then this would be zero this term. So that allows us to rewrite some of these curl expressions. Okay, so that allows us to write this integral minus I k n hat dot x prime, the curl of A, d cubed x prime, as I k times integral d cubed x prime minus ik n hat dot x prime n hat cross A of x prime. Which is nice because basically every curl in the double asterisk equation we will replace del prime cross any quantity, basically, by ik n hat cross that quantity. And I really like that because it's easier to take a cross product than a curl. Isn't that beautiful? Math. As in the movie The Martian, we're going to science the shit out of this problem. You've all seen that movie. Okay, so finally, this is the final result for the Born approximation. Our scattering amplitude, which is a vector. Remember, it's a vector giving the electric displacement vector. And from that, we can derive all the rest of the radiation fields and the pointing vector, all that good stuff. Works out to be k squared over 4 pi volume integral. We still have e to the minus I k n hat dot x prime, which means basically we're taking the Fourier transform of the source, is all this is. That's what the Born approximation is. It's a Fourier transform of a source. Even in quantum mechanics, you can think of it that way. Except we've rewritten the source in this slightly simpler version to work with, d naught minus epsilon naught e, where these are going to be our incident fields. And that has an additional cross product with n hat. That'll be the, well, let me, I'll say some words about this after I write it. Epsilon naught omega over k n hat crossed into b minus mu naught h. But we can give it, this is just looks like some ugly math integral, but we can give some physical interpretation to these two terms. That if you compare with the formulas like for an electric dipole scatterer, the shape of the electric fields have something that look just like that, n cross p crossed n hat. And so you can see that you should interpret this term as the scattering by the induced electric dipoles. And this term, similarly, if you look at, there's an n hat cross m vector in the magnetic dipole radiator. So this will be scattering by the magnetic dipoles induced in our material. And these results are usually expressed in terms of what you would measure at a detector, which would be a differential cross-section for some polarization vector at the detector. So we can collect our scattering amplitude and cast our answer in that language. The differential cross-section. To observe scattered light or radiation, observe of polarization epsilon, or I guess E, I'm little lowercase e. At the detector will be d sigma d omega is the magnitude of E conjugated, might be circular or elliptic polarization, dotted into the scattering amplitude, which is that integral, its absolute square, and divided by the incident electric displacement squared. So these formulas, this one combined with that formula for the scattering amplitude as that integral, is what we call the first order Born approximation, which is just a term for the perturbative scattering theory to first order. Thank you, Max Born, wherever you are. Although actually it was derived, he derived this in around 1930 in quantum mechanic context. It was actually derived long before that by Lord Rayleigh. I wish I was a Lord, but I'm not. Ah, c'est la vie. He derived it in the context of E&M, more like in 1881. And don't forget that these quantities in our integral, d minus epsilon naught e, we could write, we are approximating that by delta epsilon of x prime over epsilon naught times d naught. And similarly, we're approximating b minus mu naught h in that integral by the unperturbed values delta mu of x over mu naught times b naught in the incident field. Okay, we can write things out, make it all a little bit more concrete and explicit, these integrals. I mean, it's all here, basically, but we can put it in a little more convenient form for your next homework assignment. Because we will write our incident waves, the electric displacement for a monochromatic wave coming in as an incident polarization vector times an incident amplitude and a incident plane wave in the n0, n0 direction. And we'll write b0 incident in the vacuum as mu naught over epsilon naught to the 1/2 n naught hat crossed into d naught of x. Well, and so this e hat conjugate dotted into the scattering amplitude over d naught will be k squared over 4 pi integral d cubed x e to the I q dot x. Q, I'll define over here, is the difference in the wave vectors incident minus scattered. Of course, the magnitude of the incident and scattered wave vector, wave numbers are the same, but their directions are different. And you can think of this as like the momentum transfer vector. When you learn the Born approximation in quantum mechanics, you talk about momentum transfer because h bar k is, of course, the momentum vector of the particle that is incident and then scattered. So this h bar times q, if this was a quantum problem, would represent the momentum transferred. And in fact, if you think of doing this experiment in the one photon limit, one photon came in and scattered, then actually this would be the momentum transfer of the photon if you multiply it by h bar. Okay, so anyway, this q comes into all my integrals. And we have the vector nature of the fields in these dot products, E star dot E naught, unit vectors, and delta epsilon of x over epsilon naught, supposed to be a small thing, plus then the magnetic dipole part n hat cross E hat star dotted into n hat N naught hat cross E naught hat delta mu of x over mu naught. Okay. So that's a little simpler final expression. And we can just immediately do this for a uniform dielectric sphere. And I'll just go ahead and give you the result. You can see if you can come up with this yourself at home. That this should be k squared. If it's uniform, it'll factor outside of the integral. We'll just have the electric dipole part, E hat star dot E naught. And then the integral ends up giving something that depends on this q, which is the momentum transfer vector. Only its magnitude comes in, sine of qa minus qa cosine of qa. They're elementary integrals, easy to do, over q cubed. And if we take the q goes to zero limit, this quantity in parentheses approaches a cubed over 3. And so you're basically getting that either this would represent the low frequency limit, is one way to get to q going to zero, or the forward direction at any frequency. Near the forward direction, there's very little momentum transfer, and q will be small, even at higher frequencies, if you go to close enough to the forward direction. And in that limit, this agrees with what we derived before for a dielectric sphere in the long wavelength, or small q approximation. Which is a nice check to compare with the different way we solved that problem in the long wavelength limit. So I'm claiming limit as q goes to zero of d sigma d omega is in fact k to the fourth a to the sixth magnitude of delta epsilon over epsilon naught squared. E hat conjugate dot E zero squared, which agrees with 10.6 for a small dielectric sphere. Okay. That is all I want to say about perturbative scattering theory. Next time, you might want to read ahead. We're going to make use of all we've learned about vector spherical harmonics and see how you can calculate scattering phase shifts for electromagnetic waves, just the way you do in quantum mechanics, where phase shifts control everything. You've all learned about scattering phase shifts in quantum. Doesn't ring a bell? Really? Okay. Well, that'll be cool. You'll be way ahead of your quantum friends who when you learn phase shifts in quantum after next lecture. Okay, see you. And if you came in late, I do have a homework assignment posted, and it's due in just 1 week, but it's just one part of one of Jackson's problems, and it's a very short assignment. After today's lecture, you've got the toolkit to solve it. See you on Monday. Okay. Sure. ER?
Yeah, I cut my foot open.
Oh.
Dropped a knife on it.
Oh, okay. I did that. Didn't go to the ER. Maybe I should have. It bothered me for a year. Okay, was there blood gushing like in a Monty Python movie?
Yeah, it was quite dramatic.
Oh, I wish I could have seen it. No one filmed it?
No, I should have.
Darn. Okay, anyway, sorry to hear. I hope it gets better soon. And don't worry about that. Just get him when you can.
So do you think Max Born based the Born approximation off of the previous work that was already done for you?
I kind of doubt it, but I never read his paper, actually. I think I glanced at it once, but I should look at the references in his paper.
Because I'm curious if it was purely just like a first principles kind of derivation to get like the Born approximation, or if he was at all inspired.
He was so good at math, he just did it. Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised by that, too.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people during that time in like those early stages of quantum mechanics were kind of